minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed mind.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia on the National Community Radio Satellite. Listen to the Anarchist World This Week, Australia's sacred cow, slaughterhouse. Listen to analysis of local, national, international events. Listen to analysis you'll never hear anywhere else.
To the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. My name's Joseph Toscano. I'm hosting today's program. The program is coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. My name's Joseph Toscano. Unfortunately, over the next 3 weeks, the Anarchist World This Week will be pre-recorded, because I won't be around. Yes, I'm coming back in March, the first week in March. So what I've decided, instead of having repeats, life goes on, that we need to pre-record. So I'm going to do some theoretical stuff. Some you may have heard before, some you may not have heard. And if you're a new listener, you wouldn't have heard it. But if you're wondering what anarchy is all about, anarchos means without rulers, not without rules. That's right, without rulers. What gives rulers the ability to determine the lives of billions of people? Inequalities in power and wealth. The anarchist struggle is the struggle to devolve, share power, possibly through direct democratic means, and to hold wealth in common and use it for the common good. Simple concepts which people have been struggling for. Many have paid the ultimate price for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And today I'd like to look at two things: class in Australia, and possibly define some of the words which we use consistently, but somehow seem to forget that other people may not know what we're talking about. So class analysis, class in Australia in 2026. I'm not a Marxist. I've never been a Marxist. I'm an anarchist. What I look at when I look at class in Australia in 2026 is everyday reality. The concept of class has changed through the 19th and 20th century, but unfortunately, most radical activists have been left behind using the traditional class analysis as their guiding light. Now, I have never been crucified to the past. The past is the past, the present is the present, the future is the future. And although the past has an impact on the present and the future, it's the present that determines the future. And if you do not understand the situation you find yourself in, the chances of making change, any significant change, are minuscule, if not impossible. So let's look at class in the 21st century in Australia. Now, obviously, there can be variations in other parts of the world. I'm not saying that what I'm describing suits everybody. It doesn't. But what I do think is it gives us a grounding into the type of society we are. Now, in Australia, we have four distinct classes. And these classes are not defined by the type of work you do. Whether you're working at the point of production, whether you're working, you know, as a white-collar worker, a blue-collar worker, a manager, whether you're working as a professional, as a university-educated professional. Class in Australia in the 21st century is determined by wealth and ultimately by the amount of disposable income you have at the end of the week once you've paid for your everyday necessities, shelter, food, health, education, security, etc. So wealth determines class, as I said before, not whether you're a white-collar, blue-collar, professional, unemployed, skilled, semi-skilled, business owner, wage slave. It's about wealth. Although many people think they're part of a particular class, it doesn't actually mean they are part of that class. Now, as I said before, class in Australia can be divided into four distinct segments. And each segment is determined on wealth. Now, there's the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange, and communication. Now, the 1% are the wealthiest segment of our society. We may never see them, or we may see them, but they have extraordinary amounts of disposable income because they own more than 50% of this country's resources. That's the 1% that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange, and communication. Now, we're all familiar with this particular group. And most of these people are entrepreneurs, investors, technocrats, and the list goes on and on. Now, the next class is a class that has evolved over the last 50 years or so in Australia, a significant class of people, because it has determined the type of ideology that is prevalent in this country. And that's an ideology based on investment. Now, John Howard, although he was ousted from his seat when he lost the unlosable election because of his work choices legislation, the fact is that he was able, with a helping hand from the Hawke Keating Labor government, to create a new class of Australians which broke down the traditional white-collar, blue-collar mould. And this is the investment class. 8% of Australians, roughly 8% of Australians, can be described as being involved in the investment class. They are not as rich as the 1%, but they do have disposable income at the end of the day. They can be self-employed. They can be senior government bureaucrats. They can even be people who've been in a job for a lifetime. But at the end of the day, what they all have in common is they have money left over. Money left over after they've paid for their essentials, their home, their food, their mobility, their holidays. They still have money left over. So what do they do with this money? Through the legislative process, we have seen more and more Australians channeled into the investment class. the aspirational class, if you wish to call them anything. We've seen the financial sector structured in such a way as to encourage these people to buy a second or a third or a fourth home as an investment prospect because of Australia's investment-friendly laws. Then we have the financial sector encouraging people to buy shares and bonds in the stock market, whether it's local or international, because of dividend imputation, which means they basically get a tax deduction for buying shares and bonds. So when somebody with disposable income puts their money in the bank, the return is limited, negligible in some cases. But if they go to a financial advisor and put their excess assets into some type of investment vehicle, then they have the potential to create wealth without working for that portion of their income. So the investment class, as I said, is exceptionally important in the psychology of Australians, because everybody would love to be part of this group of people. Well, not everybody, but most people, because it means they could enjoy their lives without the necessity to work. Not that many people in the investment class find themselves in that situation, but many people in the investment class find that when they retire, they have more assets than they would have had in the first place, and the type of retirement they have is a very pleasant one. So you've got the 1% and then you've got the 8%. Now, the great majority of Australians, whether they're self-employed in terms of running small businesses. Now, going back to the investment class, I'd just like to make a correction. The investment class, it doesn't matter whether you're a professional, university-educated professional, a senior bureaucrat, a small business owner that employs labour, whether you're a white-collar worker, whether you're a tradesperson who's got disposable income at the end of the week, it doesn't matter the colour of your collar or the type of work you do, as long as you make that excess money, which you then reinvest in the system, that makes you part of the investment class. Then you've got the great majority of Australian workers. The great majority of Australian workers either own small businesses or are wage earners. You can be a wage earner for a local council, the state government, the federal government. You can be a wage earner for private business. And the thing about being, you can be a professional and be a wage earner working in some type of institution. But the thing about being a wage earner or a small business person is, if at the end of the week, apart from maybe having a little bit of excess to have a holiday, you and your family, if at the end of the week there is no disposable income you can invest outside compulsory superannuation contributions, there is no investment component, you are part of that traditional working class. Whether you work for yourself, whether you work for government, whether you work for private enterprise, whether you're a white-collar worker, whether you're a blue-collar worker, whether you work two jobs, the fact is that at the end of the week, if there is no disposable income, you are part of the working class. So if you've got the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication, the upwardly mobile 8% that have disposable income, that means they can create a future for themselves through investment in resources where there's a tax advantage. Then you've got the working class, which is the majority of people. It's about 60% of people, 60, 62% of people are part of the working class. So it's not related to whether you use your hands or your brain. It's not related whether you're IT or a doctor. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's the disposable income that matters. So if most of your income goes to meeting your everyday needs, shelter, food, security, mobility, and the list goes on, educating your children, then you're part of that working class. And finally, we have the 30-plus percent of Australians who rely on social security benefits to survive. People on old age pensions, people on disability support pensions, people on Newstart allowance, people on single parents benefits, and there are, you know, a whole host of benefits. The income that comes from being on a social security benefit, apart from the blind pension, which is not related to income, is determined by your lack of income. In many ways, social security payments are there to provide stability in a community. You don't want large sections of the community to not be able to access the basic necessities of life, because that creates confusion, and more importantly, it creates inequality, it creates resentment and resistance to the state. So these are the four classes that I recognise, and I think it's a simple way. It's not a perfect way. It's not etched in concrete or stone, but it is a simple way to understand the type of society we live in. You've got the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication. You have the 8% that are part of the investment class. You have the 60% that are part of the working class, and the 31-32% that are part of the social security benefits class. Now, obviously, people in the different groups have different attitudes to life. And many people in the investment class just think they're ordinary workers because they've got a stable job, which gives them an excess resources. And many people who are described as working class, especially if they're small business owners, would never describe themselves as working class. But that's the reality that we face on a day-to-day basis. That's everyday reality. I find it a useful way to try to determine what is what in Australian society. The only issue I have is the fact that aspiration, which is part and parcel of the private investment for private profit mantra, aspiration seems to be part and parcel of people, many people, who I describe as working class or the investment class, seems to be their major goal. So in many regards, we have this increasing gap between 70% of Australians who have options and the 30% on social security benefits who find that their options are grossly limited. Let's move on to something else. Democracy. Let's define democracy. People think they equate democracy with parliament. It's natural equation. We are told that we have the ability, through casting a ballot every 3 to 4 years, depending whether it's a state election or a federal election, to determine our rulers. I mean, that's the basis of Western parliamentary democracy. Now, many people think democracy is rule of the people, by the people, for the people. Democracy is not rule of the people, by the people, for the people. The most important ingredient in that definition is the people, an active population. Democracy is rule of the people, by the people, for the people, by an actively involved population. Representation is a little bit, for those who remember what a check is, like giving a signed blank check to a stranger and saying to them, do what you like with it. And that's what representative democracy is. In this country, representative democracy is not about electing independents to promote your ideas. It's about promoting or electing a political party which has a majority in both houses of or the lower house of parliament, which then has the ability to carry out legislation. That's what parliamentary democracy is. It's a signed blank check to your representative. Now, representatives are not ultimately responsible to the people they represent. Their first responsibility is to the political party they are part of. And if you vote for a political party, the fact is that although you may have an idea of what their policy is, what policies will be enacted and what won't be enacted is a matter for is a matter based on faith. It's a little bit like believing in God. Now, I don't believe in God, but many listeners believe in God, and that's fine by me. It's not an issue. But you need faith. I don't have that faith. So you need faith in the system that your representative will do the right thing by you. So that's what parliamentary democracy is basically based on. Faith. The problem is that your parliamentary representative has a greater responsibility to the party that pre-selects them than the electorate as a whole, because it's the party pre-selections which determines their future and their future career in the parliamentary system. And let's not forget that most parliamentarians are not there for one term or two, they're there for life, and it becomes a career via people can, you know, obviously enrich themselves and become part of the investment class. Now, a lot of people say to me, the Australian Labor Party has a historic majority in the House of Representatives, full of the Labor Party, and it has an exceptionally sympathetic Senate where the Greens hold the balance of power. So why has the federal government decided not to redistribute income like the Whitlam-led Labor government did 50 years ago? Well, it's simple. The first thing is the election of the Whitlam Labor government was due to a groundswell of opposition to conservative, to 25 years of conservative reactionary rule. So there were many community-based organisations, some with a political focus and some without, who used direct action to promote their ideas and put pressure on the elected Labor government to introduce a whole swathe of reforms. Today, there is no pressure from the community to introduce reforms. Most people are too cynical about the parliamentary process to think that reform is possible. So instead of becoming involved in movements and activities which promote direct action as against parliamentary reform, what we see is that most people tend not to be involved in anything. The great thing about living in Australian society in 2026 is there are many things you can do to divert your gaze from everyday reality. Sport, religion, hobbies, special interest groups. The reality is that if you leave politics to the professional class, you will never get change. Because, as I said before, although the Labor Party has a distinct majority and a friendly upper house, it will not introduce significant economic reform in this country, whether it's the housing sector, the education sector, the hospital sector, because it is concerned about the fact that real power does not lie in the hands of Parliament. Real power lies in the boardrooms of national and transnational corporations. So the Labor government continues to look over its shoulder every time it tries to introduce some minor reform because of the resistance which we see in a media, whether it's on a virtual platform, whether it's the legacy media, which continues to be owned and promote the interests of those owners. And that's the reality. If it doesn't promote the interests of those owners, the pushback against any attempt to change parliamentary legislation is huge. And what happens is we see governments buckle because they're concerned that they will lose their majority and their ability to govern at the next election. And that's the reality. And that's why in 2026 we still have 25,000 children living in who are homeless. We have over 3 million children living in poverty. We have 30% of the population living on social security benefits, which basically, you know, feed you and clothe you and nothing else. And the list goes on and on. It's an extraordinary situation. Let's move on. Let's look at the concept of nationalisation. What is nationalisation? Nationalisation is when the government takes over a privately owned enterprise. That's right. You can have nationalisation with no compensation and nationalisation where the government buys the private enterprise with compensation. So as we see around the world today, we see what happens when governments nationalise private enterprise. We saw in Iraq when the so-called coalition of the willing toppled Hussein. Iraq's oil resources went to the private sector. A number of years later, once the Iraqis had regained power in their own country, they re-nationalised those oil services. We see it in Venezuela, where the country has been basically invaded so the United States can control its oil supplies. So nationalisation was when the government of the day has the courage to take over private enterprise without compensation. That's what nationalisation is. And I promote and have promoted for years the ideas that this country's resources, this country's wealth, should be owned and distributed not just to the original owners and everybody else in this country. For far too long, we have allowed locally owned companies and privately, internationally owned companies to exploit our resources for a peppercorn return while enriching their major shareholders. So nationalisation should be nationalisation without compensation should be on everybody's agenda. If you want to resolve childhood poverty, if you want to resolve inequality, if you want to resolve the fact there are never enough resources for public hospitals and public infrastructure and public education, well then nationalisation is the way to resolve that pressing issue. Now, sometimes you will hear me use terms like corporatisation, globalisation, privatisation, deregulation. So they're fancy words. What do they really mean? How have these concepts transformed society since the 1970s, in the last 50 years? Because in the last 50 years, we have had an ideological program which has been created in order to claw back the gains that working people made through struggle, through reform movements, through revolution. All those gains that we take for granted for far too long, like a national health system, three public hospitals, three public education, essentially three public infrastructure, and the list goes on and on. For far too long, we have accepted that these rights are chiseled in stone. They're not chiseled in stone. And over the last 50 years, we have seen what happens when these ideological structures become almost religious items. The first one, deregulation. What is deregulation? Now, obviously, there are regulations which can be a bit obsequious and annoying. But the majority of regulations which have come into place have come into place to protect people from the private sector. Regulations regarding food production, regulations regarding how factories work, regulations regarding the type of compensation people receive for being wage slaves, and the list goes on and on. There's all these regulations which have come into play through parliamentary actions and through reform actions that protect people's health, protect people's livelihood. And what we have seen over the last 50 years is a philosophical ability for governments to justify the removal of regulations which were put in place to protect people. And that's what deregulation is about. Whether it's the environment, the natural environment, where corporations are baying for the blood of the environmental movement by saying there are too many regulations which protect the environment, whether it's health concerns within a workplace, the regulations involved in community security, and the list goes on and on. So deregulation is a philosophical, ideological mechanism via which gains that have come through parliamentary reform are removed in order to increase profitability for the private investment for private profit mob. That's deregulation. The next big one is privatisation. Now, a lot of people are under the mistaken belief that public utilities belong to the people. Well, public utilities do not belong to the people. They belong to the government of the day. And we've seen this over and over again. The only way that private utilities could belong to the people in Australia is through their inclusion in this, their ownerships included in the Australian Constitution. And because Parliament is the only group that can enact constitutional change, referendums, we will never see that. The reality is, what we've seen over the last 50 years is the privatisation, bargain basement fire sales of public assets which were built up over generations of people paying taxation to the state. For example, the Commonwealth Bank was formed in 1911. It was formed because ordinary people, wage earners, could not get any money from banks in order to buy housing. And over the years, it became Australia's predominant banking arm. And it was privatised by the Hawke-led Labor government, I think, in the 1980s. What that meant is it was sold to the private sector without the government going to the people in a referendum asking them whether they wanted to privatise, give away for a bargain basement price this essential commodity, this service to the private sector. So we saw the privatisation of the Commonwealth Bank. We saw the privatisation of the Commonwealth Serum Laboratory. I think their shares are about $250 a share. They were sold by the Keating-led Labor Party by, I think, $3.20 a share. We saw the privatisation of Telecom. We saw the privatisation of Qantas, the government-owned airline. At a state level, we have seen the privatisation of energy distribution and energy manufacturing companies. So we saw what was an essential service, energy, the ownership of energy production, transferred from the public sector to the private sector. And what that has meant is over the years that we've seen a explosion in prices which revolve not around production but around increasing profitability for shareholders. So the only people who have actually benefited through privatisation are the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication and this country's investment class. Everybody else have had to pay extra for the privilege of having public sector institutions privatised. On top of that, there's an increase, more important, more important reaction or response. In the financial sector, and we can talk about all the sectors, but in the financial sector, what occurred is that when the Commonwealth Bank was privatised, what that meant is that the financial sector was dominated by private banks. And we saw an explosion in fees and charges and an explosion in lack of competition as the four corporations attempted to maintain and expand their market share at the expense of the people because there was no real competition. You're not going to get one big bank competing against another big bank, possibly on a peripheral level, but not a major level. So we see the lack of competition and to a significant degree, the increasing prices of housing is directly related to the governments at the state level privatising large sections of the public housing sector and not outline resources to build more public housing. It's all about decreasing the public housing sector and increasing the private sector. And if you increase the private sector while you're not increasing the public sector, what happens is that competition goes out the door. So privatisation means one, that you lose access to essential services at a reasonable price because they're government-owned and government-managed. And two, what it means is there's a distinct lack of competition in the economy because it is totally dominated by the private sector. And this has profound implications for millions of Australians. Some were foreseen, many weren't foreseen, and it's not because private enterprise is more efficient, it's about maximising profit to shareholders. Then we have globalisation. What's globalisation? Well, it's a simple concept. It means the world economy is one economy. And if you manufacture stuff and you've got to pay somebody $30 an hour and you transfer your business to Taiwan or China or Japan or wherever, and you pay people, or Peru or Indonesia, and you pay Thailand, you pay people $2 an hour, well, then your profits are going to increase. So what we saw in the 80s and 90s with globalisation in this country is that more and more and more businesses shut their doors and transferred their activities, whether it was IT, whether it was manufacturing, offshore in order to maximise profits for their major shareholders. That's what globalisation is. And what's corporatisation? Well, that's simple. Now, just in case you are going to walk into a temple of consumption on the weekend, you know, religion can be a little bit tedious and you may not be walking to your local mosque or church or temple in the next few days, but I'm pretty confident you'll be walking into your local temple of consumption. And the brilliant thing is when you walk into a temple of consumption is you will see the same brands over and over again, whether it's Broome, whether it's Adelaide, whether it's Hobart, whether it's Brisbane, whether it's Cairns. You walk into any major shopping centre and the same brands dominate economic activity in that particular sphere. You see it all the time. Corporatisation is the destruction of small business. One, making it impossible for small business to compete and therefore causing increased bankruptcy in the small business sector, and two, creating a monopoly on your activities or a duopoly on your activities because of your domination of the small business sector. And it's worse in Australia because there are no antitrust laws which force companies to be broken up. So you walk into your local temple of consumption and you will see the same brands over and over and over again. Now, a lot of people think that deregulation, privatisation, corporatisation and globalisation is what is necessary to create a sustainable, profitable economy. Now, you create a sustainable profit economy in three ways. You create profits in three ways. You squeeze your customers, you squeeze your staff, or you squeeze government to restrict what you think is restrictive legislation. In all three cases, what we see is that the benefit which is derived does not return to the customer or to the workers in that particular corporatisation. Those returns flow to the shareholders. And in a country where you have a tax deduction, dividend imputation, a tax deduction for owning shares, what companies tend to do with profits is increase dividends, yearly dividends to their shareholders. And because an increasing number of Australians are retired and have superannuation funds, many are self-managed and many are large superannuation funds, what we see is the value of a company's share on the stock market increases, not because of its financial viability, but increases because of the dividend which is paid to shareholders. So instead of excess money which is made by a corporation, helping that corporation to expand or being redistributed among its customers through cheaper prices or redistributed amongst its workers by higher wages, what we see is the majority of those profits flow to the shareholders. And in a country where your future is totally dependent on your superannuation balance when you retire, it's becoming more and more and more important for the world's stock markets to have access to your resources. Now, obviously, we want change. We want change. We want real change. Now, real change does not happen by sitting on the sidelines and tut-tutting. Real change doesn't happen by sitting in an armchair and having a beer while you're watching your favourite sporting team. Real change doesn't happen while you're chasing that exclusive piece to your collection, right? Your hobby. Change comes from below. It doesn't come from above. There are no recorded, that I'm aware of, instances in human history where the redistribution of power and wealth has been an easy transition. Those who exercise power and those who have access to wealth will do everything in their power to ensure they will continue to dominate human activity. And it's no wonder that people like you and me, who one question the status quo, who two desire change, and who three actively promote that struggle for change, that we are considered to be troublemakers. That's right, troublemakers. Somehow we are considered to be beyond the pale. What people forget is that if it wasn't for people like you and me, who are willing to do the hard yards, who are willing to be involved in extra parliamentary activity, who are willing to organise the protests, who are willing to stretch the envelope, who are willing to find yourselves marginalised and excluded from society because of the position you've taken in terms of challenging the power of those who exercise control. It's people like us that are the impetus for change, whether it's reform, whether it's radical change, whether it's revolutionary change. Change does not come by voting. You can vote the most radical person you like into power. You can give the Labor Party a significant majority in a sympathetic upper house. But change does not come unless there's a push from below for that change to be enacted in legislation. And that's the problem we face. It's a huge problem in 2026. It was a huge problem 2,000 years ago when slavery was the norm. It was a huge problem in the 18th century when child labour was the norm. It's been a huge problem in human history when violence has been the way to move forwards. We've seen the destruction of civilizations. We've seen the destructions of millions, if not billions, of people as those with power continue to use every means at their disposal, both legal and illegal, to maintain that power. You and I are involved in a long-term struggle which may involve generations after we are gone to ensure that wealth and power is held in common. And if you're involved in that struggle to devolve power through direct democratic means, and next week will be another pre-recorded program where I'll look at other terms that we use consistently on this program. I'll look at direct democracy, what it is, how it can be implemented. Look at the concept of citizens-initiated referendums. Look at the concepts of the power of recall. But the fact is, as I keep saying ad nauseum, change comes when we create that momentum for change. An old Chinese curse says, I hope you live in interesting times, which means chaotic times. Chaos doesn't necessarily mean disaster. Sometimes those who exercise power and have wealth will create chaos in order to maintain the status quo. In a situation like this, we need to remember that our aphrodisiac as activists is hope. The desire for change and the expectation that change will occur in our lifetime. Not in the never-never, but in our lifetime. And for far too long, we have believed that change is impossible. For far too long, cynicism has raised its ugly head and determined the type of society we live in. For far too long, we have acquiesced to those who exercise power in our society. We are the beginning of a movement which reinvents itself century after century after century. Our ideas go back thousands of years. For thousands of years, people have been trying to create societies where their basic needs are met and where they have the power to determine their future, their way. For far too long, we have relied on rulers to make decisions for us. While we rely on the rich and powerful to make decisions for us, nothing will ever change. Thank you for listening to this pre-recorded segment of The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station. Much appreciated. You can email me at anarchistage@yahoo.com. You can leave messages on 0439 395 489, 0439 395 489. As I said before, I'm interested in standing in the state election in the 28th of November in Victoria, for the electorate of Q, which is headed by the Liberal Party leader, Jess Wilson. If you do live in that electorate and you're interested, leave a message on 0439 395 489, 0439 395 489. I'll contact you when I get back in March. But thanks you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week, courtesy of the Community Radio Network on your local community radio station. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week via the Community Radio Network on your local community radio station. This program has been coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. YouTube channels, public interest before corporate interests. YouTube channels, josephtoscana.nam. I wish you all the best, and hopefully you'll be able to listen to another pre-recorded program next week. I will be back doing live broadcasts of the Anarchist World this week in the first Wednesday in March. Thank you once again for listening to the Anarchist World this week, courtesy of the Community Radio Network on your local community radio station.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
An analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Anarchist World this week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse, 10 a.m. every Wednesday. Listen to the Anarchist World this week for an up-to-date analysis of local, national and international events.
Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.